So this is the audio that accompanies the Campbell versus Acoff Rose fair use case. So this is our first case discussing the fair use defense. So if you remember, the beginning of 106 that gives you all your copyrights has this preamble. It says subject to sections 107 through 122. Well, it turns out fair use is section 107. So you look at the first slide, and we talk about this idea that we've got fair use as a defense. If you infringe, you can avoid remedies. Sometimes people don't say this is a defense. This essentially is a negation of the idea that you have found infringement. The burdens on fair use shift time to time, so that's why it's tough to say clearly it's a defense in all cases. Why do we have fair use? There's an equity element to it. That is, in some ways, it's unfair to charge someone with infringement in certain categories or cases, and so equities suggest that the use is fair and shouldn't be infringing. In line with our typical way we look at copyright law in the United States, there's a utilitarian rationale. That is that we would allow infringement to occur or fair use to occur if the public benefit of the infringement is greater than how much it impairs any incentive to actually create or distribute the underlying work, right? So the idea being that if on net this is publicly beneficial, the harm to the copyright incentives is smaller than the public benefit coming from the infringement, we should let it happen. And along these lines, the theory being is that if it turns out the copyright holder was reasonable, the copyright holder would license the underlying work to the infringer for zero royalty because the impact would be so minimal on them, and they would see the public that's the public benefit that's there, that a reasonable copyright owner would have allowed a zero rate royalty and allowed the infringer to actually have a license. But for some reason, those things have broken down and it doesn't occur, and so fair use forces it to occur. Section 106 identifies 107 identifies the statutory basis for fair use. If you go to slide 2, I've reproduced the preamble and the postamble to 107. We're going to take a look at the factors here in just a second. But here it says, notwithstanding the provisions of Section 106 and 106A, the fair use of a copyrighted work, including such use by reproduction in copies, etc., for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research, is not an infringement of copyright. The one thing that courts have done is they've interpreted those categories as merely kind of indicators, not conclusory. So just because I'm doing news reporting doesn't mean I've engaged in fair use, but it suggests that it is. But also, this list isn't exhaustive. Just because I don't appear on this list, I could still be engaged in fair use. And then the postamble is the idea that just because the work has been unpublished shouldn't bar a finding of fair use if a finding is made upon consideration of the above factors. So there have been some previous case law before the 76 Act's adoption of 107 that unpublished works, if you copied them without permission, that was always unfair use. That's not the case. So if you go to the next slide 3, we get identified the four factors, and essentially what happens is courts balance these four factors to determine whether fair use has occurred. And we're going to look at a series of cases and hypotheticals where we'll work through these four factors. So in determining whether the use made of a work in any particular case is fair use, the factors to be considered shall include, 1, the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of a commercial nature or is for nonprofit educational purposes, 2, the nature of the copyrighted work, 3, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyright work as a whole, and 4, the effect of the use upon potential markets for the copy or value of the copyrighted work. One of the things that we're going to find out in these four factors is that factors 1 and 4 are really going to do a lot of work in these cases. And a lot of times the theory is that factor 1 gives us a lot of indication of the public benefit of the work. How transformative is the use, is the terminology that you hear people use. And then factor 4 will give us a lot of indication as to, well, what impact is this going to have on incentives? The more harm it has to the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work, the more likely that this infringement shouldn't be fair use because it's actually going to harm the incentives. And so we're going to see this balance between the two. Okay, so Campbell versus Acoff Rose. We've got Luther Campbell in the bottom right, part of Two Live Crew. We've got Roy Orbison, who had licensed the music that's at issue to Akoff Rose Music. Music that was at issue here, right? We've got our good friend Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman song, I think a lot of you guys have heard before. And so then you also have Two Live Crew, who at the time was kind of the poster child for the explicit lyrics movement by Tipper Gore. You guys probably weren't even born yet. There was this real push by Tipper Gore to make it clear to parents which albums had explicit lyrics on them or not. And Two Live Crew was really playing this up. And so one of the songs they wanted to do was a Pretty Woman song, where they used part of the actual riff from Orbison's song, and then did a kind of a play on, we'll talk about whether it's a parody or not, of the actual lyrics. And they actually had approached Akoff Rose and said, look, we'd like to get a license so that we can do this. And eventually, I think Orbison got wind of who they are and decided that, no, I really don't want my music associated with these individuals. And so Luther Campbell, being the true businessman, said, look, we're going to do it anyway. So here is Two Live Crew's version of Pretty Woman. So then this was the verse that they claimed is the parody. So the thought here, and I have a feeling this was manufactured for litigation, was that they were providing a parody of a Roy Orbison song by first invoking the, I don't know, this kind of very perfect version of Pretty Woman, and then talking about the realities of the different types of women that are out there, etc. Not sure that was the initial thought of Two Live Crew, but the reason this was a parody was that it was invoking the original work Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison, and then critiquing it in some way. And that's the typical thought of a parody, is that I'm pushing the listener or the viewer to think of the original work, because I'm now going to make a commentary on the original work and critique it in some way. And so they go ahead and release the song. Akoff Rose Music, Roy Orbison sued them for copyright infringement. Clearly actual copying. There is some literal copying, both of the riff and some of the lyrics. Probably we got improper appropriation, but the defense by Luther Campbell and Two Live Crew is fair use. And so we can kind of go through the factors, which is what courts do. And so if you take a look at slide five, we first start with factor one, right? And this is the purpose and character of the use. And the use here we're talking about is the copyrighted, the infringing work's use. So the Two Live Crew song's use of the work. Is it transformative? When I say transformative, is it adding something in some way? And here we learn from the decision that parodies have a big plus factor toward fair use because the use here is critical. I need to make copies of the original work to critique the original work if I'm doing a parody. And that pushes toward this idea that I'm adding a lot by making the copy, and that's the social benefit that's there. This is in contrast to a satire where I'm conjuring up the original work, but not critiquing it at all. I'm not critiquing it at all. I'm actually just doing that because that then gets the listener or the viewer engaged. But then I'm not going to make a commentary on it. I'm going to have my own kind of take on it. These typical things aren't considered to be highly transformative. The classic person for satire is Weird Al Yankovic. He doesn't kind of critique the underlying songs, but he clearly makes reference to them, right? And the reason he makes reference to them is because they garner up some, I don't know, kind of thoughts or relationship to the underlying work that helps me, I don't think the song is funny or I think the song is a neat, etc. So here's a Weird Al Yankovic song, maybe semi-relevant to law school. So I don't think he's making big commentary on the underlying Rage Against the Machine song, but clearly that song provides some kind of hook to the listener, etc. These satires, not parodies, typically aren't seen to be transformative in nature, and that wouldn't push us toward fair use. One of the other big things that we look at when we look at the purpose and character of the use is its commercial nature, right? Am I selling this or am I not? Here, since the underlying work is being sold, that pushes against fair use, and so that would actually push against it. But here, the Supreme Court talks about the fact that parody, particularly because parody requires copying, this factor one is going to push heavily toward fair use, highly transformative. So what about factor number two, the nature of the copyrighted work? This is now not looking at the infringement. This is looking at the actual work and seeing how central it sits under copyright law. The song here, Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison, very expressive song. The court finds this to push heavily against fair use. This is something that sits at the core of what we're trying to incentivize in copyright law. And so we're going to provide it more protection, less things are going to be fair use there. So then onto the next page of the slides, right? What about the factor number three? This is on page six of the slides, amount, substantiality of the portion used. This is in relation to the copyrighted work, right? That is, okay, I'm going to take a look at the infringing work and say, how much did you use of the actual copyrighted work? We look at both quantity and quality. The raw more that's copied, that pushes against fair use. But even if a little bit's copied, but you're copying the kind of highly valued or highly recognized portions of the work, that pushes against fair use because we're thinking about it affecting the market for the actual underlying copyrighted work. Here, the court says, look, you copied a lot of it, and you copied the kind of common parts that people would think of with regard to the song. Now, it turns out with parodies, this is going to be the case, right? If you really want to conjure up the original work, I need to copy the highly kind of high-quality portions of the work. The other thing that courts will do on factor three, although we're supposed to be looking at, okay, I'm going to compare how much is used in the infringing work to the copyrighted work. We might also just look at the infringing work by itself and say, okay, look, how much percentage of the infringing work is the copyrighted work? And the more of that, the higher percentage, the less likely it's fair use. If we think about this in relation to factor one, that means it's just the less transformative the work is, right? And so, again, here with this one, if I listen to Two Live Crew's version, a lot of it is the copied elements, the riff, the refrain, a lot of the lyrics, that pushes against fair use. And then finally, factor number four, right, the effective use on potential markets for and the value of the copyrighted work. One of the things the court talks about here, which is unique to parodies, is that there might be market harm from the criticism, right? The fact that they're making fun of and critiquing Roy Orbison's view of what is the kind of ideal woman, that could have market harm. We can't, the court says we can't consider that with factor number four because we're dealing with a parody. However, the one thing the court does do, and they actually remand it to the lower court to take a look at this, is they want to look at the harm of the derivative market. That is, if we've got this song by Two Live Crew, does it prohibit or limit the ability for Roy Orbison to license out a rap or R&B version of Pretty Woman? That would be a legitimate derivative market that this use could potentially harm, and we need to remand it to the lower court to see whether there's an impact there. If you go to the next slide, slide seven, right, we continue to look at this effect of the use on the potential market. The fact that this was commercial infringement creates a presumption of harm that we have to kind of push back against. But the court says, you know what, we're only going to say that there's a presumption of harm if we have commercial infringement. And the presumption here meaning that now we would shift it to Two Live Crew to prove that there's not commercial harm if this is a non-transformative copy. But here it's a transformative copy because it's a parody. And if we have a parody, we're not going to presume the harm to the market because it's not the exact type of work, right? Would you presume that the Two Live Crew song would actually substitute for sales of the Roy Orbison song? I think that'd be a hard presumption to make, even though it's commercial. The big thing with factor four is there's some difficulties here. First is, how do we determine a potential market? We can think of actual markets, right? If the infringing copy is a direct substitute for the copyrighted work, it's going to be really hard to find fair use. That is, that somebody would buy the infringing work instead of the actual copyrighted work, unlikely to find fair use there. The bigger difficulty is whether the infringing work sits in another market, right? So here, the infringing work sits in the rap market. Roy Orbison's song sits in the kind of pop rock market. I doubt there's direct competition between the two, right? But the pushback from Roy Orbison is, hey, you're killing my licensing market in the R&B market or rap market. How do we know that's a true potential market? And not only is it a true potential market, it's got to be a significant impact to my ability to get into that market. And the big thing with these is there's a big circularity concern, because if I don't find it to be fair use, that means then you need a license to use it in that market. In some ways, I've created the market. But to create the market, I have to determine that it's not fair use. In a litigation, we're always going to have a potential market, right? The potential market here is that Two Live Crew wants a license to Roy Orbison's work. Does that mean that there's truly a rap market for rock songs, right, to license these in that particular market? And so courts really have to watch out from basically saying in every one of these cases that we've got a factor four pushing against fair use because we've got a potential market, right? What's that potential market? The potential market is the infringer. Right. Well, if that's the case, then that means there's never fair use because factor four is always pushing against fair use. And so that was what they remanded it back down to the lower court. And this case eventually settles. But whether there really is a market that we would be concerned about, and then we have to weigh that against the factor one kind of parity benefits here. So then getting to the last slide, slide eight, what do we do in the end? We balance these four factors. Most of these cases come down to balancing factor one and factor four. And typically factor one focuses on public benefit. So here we've got a parody, the social commentary, how much social commentary is being made, how much is Two Live Crew adding to the discourse and discussion around what is what do we mean by the terminology Pretty Woman. And then we would compare that to, okay, well, what are going to be the harms to the copyright incentives if we allow this type of infringement, these parodies from taking place. And the harm here is the question of, well, how does it hurt the ability for a copyright holder to exploit these derivative markets, right? A song in a different context or a different genre, and we would take a look at the between those there. And this is what you would typically see in the end. And I know factors 2 and 3, actually what's interesting in this case, pushed against fair use, although there's this argument that in parody cases, factors 2 and 3 will always push against fair use. So if we really want to protect parodies, we don't want it to happen. Rarely do you see 2 and 3 kind of carry the day. It always seems to be 1 versus 4. And this maybe is really bringing home the utilitarian balance that fair use is trying to make, right? Is the public benefit greater than the harm to the incentives for the copyright holder? And we're going to talk about this more when we take a look again at Perfect 10 versus Amazon and then Sony versus Universal.